everybody, what's up? Glad to be with you. This is Adam Gamwell. I am the co-host and executive producer of this AnthroLife podcast.
I'm Ryan Collins, co-host of this AnthroLife podcast.
And I'm Leslie Walker. I'm the project manager for the American Anthropological Association Public Education Initiative.
We're excited to be here with you today. We're bringing you the first episode in our crossover series that is with the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, with the American Anthropological Association, and this AnthroLife podcast. And so for this first episode, we are focusing on the crafts of African fashion. And so we'll be exploring how designers, curators, and artisans approach their work, how they understand and frame African fashion and design in a transnational world. And so part of the reason that we're looking at it as a transnational enterprise is, as you recall, like the main theme of the bigger series, looking at migration, at diaspora, at transnationalism, we're, you know, really kind of thinking about how we can see ideas, textiles, fashion trends moving across borders, and both how that connects us and how that kind of differentiates us too.
So the Crafts of African Fashion is a larger initiative within Smithsonian programming that promotes the continuity of heritage arts that appear on the continent of Africa as well as in the diaspora. And in this episode, we had the opportunity of speaking with Simana Saleh, Cynthia Sands, and her young mentee, Tamara Watkins, also known as Tam, and the program's curator, Diana Beard Ndaye.
Yeah, and so our first guest today is as Leslie introduced, Diana Ndaye, and she is the curator of the Crafts of African Fashion in the Marketplace. And so it was really great to get a curatorial voice as part of this conversation. So again, we're looking with designers and curators. And so part of our questioning with her and kind of opening up these ideas is, what was she hoping and what was she looking for in terms of why bring this marketplace? Kind of, Ryan, as you said, there's been a lot of difference in terms of how markets look today in the past, but also in different parts of the world too. And so what does it mean to sort of open up an intentional market space that is a cultural and an economic exchange point at the festival?
The idea of the Crafts of African Fashion came about as an initiative to look at the craft enterprises that underlie fashion. The idea is that there are there are artisans who are creating beautiful things to wear in Africa. Often they're creating them in really ugly circumstances. And if the crafts are to continue, and if kids are going to want to do it, if people from communities are wanting to continue this, it has to be done. There has to be some attention to helping these crafts to be continued. Schools are one thing, apprenticeships are other things, cultural policy, getting together ministries of culture and labor and tourism and all of these places. We feel that the role that the Smithsonian can play is by bringing these artisans to the attention, and this relationship between artisans and designers to the fore, and just doing public education, but also helping to encourage these kinds of activities. I think that something that I've seen that I don't think is the best way to go about things is that a lot of the aid projects, they'll bring designers from abroad and they'll just take the environment, they'll take like coconuts and they'll say, okay, you can make this nice little necklace that you can sell that use coconuts, but they don't go back to the tradition and support the teachers from the tradition and really teach things that that belong within the tradition. And often it's because they don't know that. You know, they may have a degree from Parsons or FIT or somewhere else, and they'll come into a situation where they say this is a poverty alleviating craft so that people can do this, whereas I think the approach might be to, okay, what are the traditions that are already part of the culture, and how can we support master artisans to pass this these traditions on to people who need to make an income, but also who can contribute to the cultural continuity of these traditions. With putting together Crafts of African Fashion, one of our inspirations was also looking to people who were who were also trying to create schools. So Alfadi, who we're working with, is creating the design school in Niger. So is Sumana, creating a design school for artisans and combining literacy skills and craft skills. Cynthia taught for many years working with people like Tekofi Narte, Fifi Narte, who's a Dinkra cloth maker. We have other folks who couldn't come this time, but who are involved in merging craft schools and schools that deal with contemporary design skills. So that's a little bit of what our impetus was, but also how we're looking at this in a transnational sense.
First off, why make all the fuss about the marketplace? When we think about marketplaces, past and present, these are the places where people are bringing their crafts from the local community. And that doesn't just showcase a product, but it showcases the type of things that community members are engaged in. It reflects a community at large, as well as the sort of craftsmanship that you have within it. And today, you know, markets don't look like they did 1,000 years ago. Today, we tend to see our markets in the West, in malls, in areas where we're seeing sort of a cosmopolitan hodgepodge of things from all around the globe that we might be familiar with. And this is why it's important for us to take a sort of removed distance stance to that and be looking again more at that cultural specificity that's coming out that really does represent community bonds.
So during the festival, we had the opportunity of speaking with African craftsmen and artisans, but we also had the opportunity of working and speaking with African-American artists and businesswomen. So we spoke with Cynthia Sands, who is based in Washington, D.C., and she is the wife of a Foreign Service officer. And during her travels with her husband, she had the opportunity of going to Africa, to Congo in 1970. And during that time, she saw bark cloth being created, and that piqued her curiosity in the fashions of Africa. And throughout her travels in Africa, she traveled to Benin, to Cameroon, and to Ghana. And she learned more and more about African art, about dyeing, about experimenting and blending with contemporary American fashions, with traditional African artistic methods. And she now runs workshops that teach about the social development of selling craft, but also creating it. And she's had the opportunity of mentoring several students. And we spoke with one of her students in particular, Tam, who is a founder as well as an artist of her online store, which is Loads of Tan, which is a hair accessory that utilizes traditional Ghanaian fabric in hair ties and in headbands.
So there's so many things that I want to do. I'm getting ready to set up a textile studio in my home in Tacoma Park, where people can come and learn how to do some of these traditional crafts, because I think it's important, the education. Because I was a young girl, I grew up in the Petworth area in Washington, D.C., and I always loved fabric. Every Saturday, we would go buy fabric. My mother sewed, my sister sewed, my aunt was a home economics teacher, so we always were sewing. So I didn't wear my first bought clothing until I was in college. So I always had my clothes made by my sister, who is an amazing seamstress. So I grew up like that, but never understood that I could be designing these textiles. Never understood that. So it's important, even if you're not interested, if you're not going to do it, the exposure is so important for young people. I work with women and men in West Africa. Most of the men do the dyeing in West Africa. It's division of labor. So most of the tie-dye workers are men, whereas in Nigeria, most of the dyers are women of indigo. But in Ghana, they're men. So I work with mainly men in Ghana. I would love to work with women but you don't find very many women doing batik and tie and dye. I just work with people that are, I feel that are very qualified and able to do it. And I met a lot of great textile designers in Ghana, already trained. The only thing that a person like me, a diaspora, would bring to the picture is that I can understand Western markets. I could understand how the product would sell in the U.S., and I encourage them to modify their colors and their design to meet that demand. And I think that's very important, because in a lot of cases, standardization is not in Africa. I mean, they just make it, and it maybe not fit. Because there, so many times it's just a difference in their size. I tell them, Americans are big. Mm-hmm. We are big people, and that is not going to fit. And we have to learn how to standardize things. So that's where I come in, to guide people so that they can have a better market, because it's important. Mm-hmm. You know, marketing is important. Mm-hmm. And that has been, what I do, help, you know, what I do for them. A lot of times people are very skilled. They just need direction. They need to, you know, because they're used to dealing with their culture and, you know, their markets. They're just a little direction, a little encouragement. A lot of my workers say, Madame, we have you treat us so nice. I said, that you're supposed to be treated with respect and dignity. And so you're supposed to pay people according to, my husband says you can't overpay, because if you're paying a tailor more than a school teacher makes, that's not good. So I pay within a good salary within their framework, you know, within their system. So in terms of design, I love this, like I said, I love the symbols. I love to modify them to make them more contemporary. I think I am a African futurist. I've always been that way, even in school, and didn't realize that term. That term came out with the movie Panther. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very important term, because we have to look at the past, but we have to push it forward, and we have to even do better. We have to maintain quality and make these crafts of Africa, it's a national treasure. And I don't think a lot of times they really understand that, but we have to make them understand that by buying it, helping support it.
And so they'll create more. Hopefully.
And they'll create more, because I think that's the future. Africa is the future. And there's this young man that did a T-shirt. I remember his name, but praise to him. Africa is the future.
So first, I want to say that it's an equal exchange. Like, I feel like the women that I work with enrich my life just as much as they enrich mine. But like Mrs. Sand said, I think it's just what I bring to it is understanding the American market and the American consumer. So like making sure that each individual headband that's produced is the exact same size. So standardization is something that's really important. And I know when we first started, it was something that we really had to work on to make sure that we got it right. Because the American consumer, she's very picky. And she's used to shopping at retailers like Zara, which, you know, those items are machine produced and mass produced. So every single product will be the exact same measurement. But whereas in Ghana, things are being done by hand. So making sure that they produce things that are standardized is very important. Also with my team. So a lot of times I'll do my photo shoots in Ghana, and I'll invite my team along with that, just so they can understand, like, you're not just making a headband or a turban. Like, this is going to be placed on a woman and photographed in a very high fashion style so that she can see how the customer will interpret it, like, on a person. So I think those experiences are very fun for them, because that's not something that they get to do in their day-to-day, just being able to see the item being produced and going to market. So I think that's what I bring to it.
One of the other pieces that we got to talk with Cynthia and Tam about, as fashion designers and as people that work transnationally, both in the United States and on the continent of Africa, is that Black Panther, the amazing Marvel film that is taking the world by storm, has really been a generative force in expanding the popularity of African fashion in multiple locales across the planet. And so it's making it more in vogue. And this is really an interesting piece for fashion designers, because you're seeing things like kente cloth become a more popular item that you may have only seen it in certain places, but now you're seeing it move across borders. And so we talked with Cynthia and Tam about this. And so it was one of our interesting questions. We wanted to think about the role of media and the role of Hollywood specifically in influencing trends of fashion, influencing popularity of what kind of clothing people want to wear, what they're looking for, what they think is in vogue. And so we, as digging into this, we of course recognize that there was a long history of Hollywood being entangled with the way fashion and trends and the way people want to dress and look nice.
African costume designers, they play an important role in dictating and predicting trends within fashion that are to come up. So outfits that are worn in movies oftentimes become copied by retailers and designers. So in the 1920s, you had silent film actresses like Clara Bow, who popularized the bob haircut as well as sailor pants and pleated skirts. And in the 1950s, you have actresses like Audrey Hepburn, who also presented a different and alternative feminine look that countered ideals of the curvier woman of Grace Kelly and Elizabeth Taylor. But sometimes fashion becomes so interwoven within the costume design that it becomes positioned as product placement in the limelight. So a great example of this is with American Gigolo that was released in 1980, that Giorgio Armani had styled a lot of the suits and they were prominently featured in the film. So in the 1980s, you see an increase of Giorgio Armani suits being bought and purchased in the United States. So films like Black Panther, they illustrate the impact of Hollywood blockbusters on the fashion industry. And in 2018, during New York Fashion Week, many designers included pieces that were inspired by the film Black Panther, and Black Panther itself was inspired by contemporary and traditional African fashion.
In between the time we were thinking about this and putting it together, and the summer, of course, Black Panther happened. And that has been such a boost to so many people who create African fashion. Of course, in the film, as the costume designer Ruth Carter and her associates have mentioned, they've done actually research to find out the different traditions to be represented in the film. The so-called tribes, and you can probably see my little hands going quotes, or the ethnic groups that they're representing, are ethnic groups that are all around the continent. And you can see in the film, there's a Dinkra cloth from Ghana, worn by T'Chaka, I think it is, the father. T'Chaka, when he's in the world of the ancestors. And you can also see that T'Challa, his son, is wearing little strips of kente. There's also elements of Tuareg culture and elements of culture from around the continent. And it's helped to grow a thirst among people in the United States and in a lot of places to really know some of the background.
I have not been in Ghana since Black Panther came out. I remember I was in Ghana before the movie was getting ready to come out. Now, a lot of my friends, they were educated abroad, and they come from families that are pretty affluent in Ghana. So as it relates to fashion, they tend to still wear more Western brands. They will wear traditional fabric and prints when they go to more formal type of events. But I do know a lot of designers there that are responsible for the reemergence of the brands that you saw in the movie like Panther. So, for example, like a brand like Christy Brown, Mina Evans. Actually, Christy Brown designed Beyonce's costumes for I'm a Grown Woman. Yeah, so she's a designer based in Ghana. She designed that. I think it's coming out. I just wish a lot more of the younger people would start to wear it in more common settings, to wear the traditional like African prints and batik fabric in non-traditional African settings. So like if you're going to class or if you're going to work, like these prints are also appropriate. And I think that's what I would like to see.
So, I mean, I just think we should continue producing beautiful textiles. We should continue marketing beautiful textiles. And, you know, the movie industry should continue making films like Panther. Because for so long, the movie, I really blame the movie industry for a lot of miseducation of me as a child. You know, for instance, the cowboy movies. I mean, I used to watch him. I used to love John Wayne. Mm-hmm. It is just pitiful. So, you know, I just didn't know. I just didn't understand. I had nobody tell me. So, no, the movie industry can correct all of that. I mean, if we just making the movies, we continue making beautiful textiles, people see them, people want to buy them, because they set the standard. You know, the movie industry, magazines, billboards, what do you call it, Madison Avenue, mm-hmm. they set the standards. So if these you know, fashions are portrayed in a good light, I think they will be embraced.
You know, so as we kind of step out of this conversation, one of the most interesting pieces that we took away from thinking about is this question of appropriation, right, and cultural appropriation. When is somebody or one group stealing or taking, you know, in this case, an article of clothing, a fashion form, and using it sort of out of context without permission in a way that might be culturally insensitive or seen as not so good. And it's a really fascinating question. And we all have a lot of thoughts on this because, you know, Black Panther as a massive blockbuster Hollywood film, hugely influenced, you know, a lot more people trying to get African fashion of different kinds, different weavings, different cloth textile patterns, as we've said. But I mean, I don't know, Leslie, what do you think? Like, what happens in this? Like, when do we cross that line? You know, where is that line?
I think what's important to identify with cultural appropriation is that it's the adoption of elements of one culture that is used in another. And it's important to distinguish how the appropriation is often at the end of unequal cultural exchange due to the imbalance of power that is commonly associated with byproducts of colonialism and oppression. And the usual offenders of cultural appropriation are white people who benefit from the privilege of having this colonial legacy. And the common occurrences happen with minority and indigenous communities who may use these products and goods in a way of cultural patrimony that is sacred or has a cultural identity, but then it's divorced from that and sold in markets.
I think it's really important to recognize two things. First of all, the way that these crafts are going to flourish and keep alive is that people are going to wear them. I mean, a lot, you know, we wear clothing from all over. I mean, you know, Africans are wearing European clothing, and people of African descent are wearing European clothing, and or clothing from Asia, clothing from everywhere. But the appropriation comes when designers are creating and they're not giving credit to the people who are the actual progenitors of the textiles and the things that they're doing. So it's at the level of the designing and making, and also in the fact that within when you're talking about appropriation, you need to really look at the traditions that are being taken by middle people who are paying nothing to the people who are making the crafts, and then selling them for much more than it cost, at very, very high profit margin. Not everything is profit margin. We know enough to know that, you know, getting goods over here is expensive, and something that people may pay a few dollars for, you know, on the continent, by the time you get through shipping and you get through marketing and all, it's going to cost more. But at the same time, you know, the idea of buying things for pennies and then selling them for hundreds of dollars, you know, that can't go on. And that I put in the category of appropriation.
I feel like the unfortunate part about this is that when you look at it from a numbers of financial business perspective, if we only sold to melanated consumers, the business would not be able to survive. And I am okay with non-melanated consumers purchasing and appreciating the things that we produce, as long as we can educate them, and as long as they understand it, and as long as the people who benefit from that purchase are, you know, of that origin, then I'm completely okay with it. Because the reality is if we don't do it and benefit off of it financially, someone else will, and they already are doing that.
I really agree with that. I just think that if you wear African fashion, I like that word, melanated. I've never heard that before. Non-melanated, that's a new term. Well, whether you're non-melanated or melanated, if you have it on, that means you have an appreciation, and it shows that you are a citizen of this global community, because that's what we are. We're all now intertwined in this global community, and I think it's wonderful that you would want to wear African fashion. You have that kind of, you are just that special. You can put it on.
I think it's important that Tam evoked the term melanated. And of course, melanated refers to melanin. And she's specifically using melanated to identify people of African descent, but possibly Latinos as well. And melanin is the pigment that gives color to human skin, our hair, and our eyes. And it's created by melanocytes. And this is protective. It's something that has evolved within humans to provide protection against skin damage of the sun. And we as human beings, we all have melanin. It's just that folks that are closer to the equator, they have darker skin. And melanated, again, speaks to folks of African descent. Tam is saying that for African fashion to survive, that it needs to not only be purchased by African Americans or people from the African diaspora, but from anybody. But she doesn't want African fashion to be reduced to simply as exotic fashion, that it's something that's edgy or something that's new, but that it's something that you can wear proudly, but you understand why it's worn and what it means to the communities that are creating it, and that they benefit, that they are the ones that are benefiting from the commerce of it, and that it doesn't one divorce from their culture, but that they don't reap the benefits of being the cultural practitioners of it.
I was talking to a lady this weekend at the African Art Museum, and she was saying that she feels like designers who make African print clothing, or who design things that are constructed of African print clothing, should make it more wearable, so that she doesn't feel like she only has to break it out for a funeral or for an event that requests that for you to wear African attire. And I completely agree with that. I do feel like we need to modernize the designs so that people don't feel like they only have to wear it to a funeral. Like, you can wear it to work, you can wear it to class. And I think at the end of the day, like, the reality is that we are competing with large retailers like Zara and H&M, who will take that cheap fabric from China and incorporate it into a more modern design. So I just think from a financial perspective, like, we have to if we want to see this industry survive.
I think there's a valuable piece that really struck me too, to be aware of, like, well, they are in the business of selling clothing, and they're certainly doing it in the United States on purpose, right? And so to see that is really quite an interesting piece. And then something else that Tam said that struck me too was thinking about, what does it mean to sort of have, you know, the context in which you might wear certain African fashions? You know, she mentions at a funeral, for example, and how do we take that? You know, she even says, like, how do we intentionally move that in a different context where it's like, you wouldn't necessarily take the actual funeral suit, but maybe some of the textile patterns, for example, and then move those into a different context in that. So you might wear it in a head wrap, you might wear it on a jacket or something. And so I thought it was really quite interesting to think with, you know, also, again, what are the role of designers in sort of propagating and moving these fashions across borders?
So far, I've traveled, I think, to 8 African countries, and each country has its own cloth or own printed fabric that's popular in that specific market. And actually, when you see African print, you'll see a lot of the prints that we see are old, and they all have not names assigned to them by the market women that would sell them. And it could be the same exact print, but in Nigeria, they may call it something else. In Ghana, they may call it something else. So whenever I travel, I always try to buy fabric that is sold in that area. And then, of course, I ship it back to Ghana and I have my team construct our products out of that. So when I travel to Ethiopia, they also make a woven fabric that is similar, very similar to what you see as kente in Ghana. Or like if you go to Turkey, for example, you'll also see woven fabric. And when I look at the fabric, I'm like, oh my gosh, like this looks similar to kente, or it looks similar to the fabric that you see in Ethiopia. So my takeaway from that is we're a lot more similar than we think due to migration. We're all influenced by one another.
Sumana Saleh next. And what's interesting is that a theme that connects these speakers is this question of relationship between the maker, the craftsman, the craftsperson, and that who you know buys or purchases their crafts and their wares. And so Sumana Saleh comes from Niger, and he has a really interesting story that, you know, we kind of asked him, you know, how did you get started? He's a master leather workman, craftsman. He loves working with lamb, is one of his favorite ones. He said it's one of the most supple leathers. You can do almost anything with it. And he actually began working with leather when he was 11 years old. And I actually got to sit down with a conversation with him and our anthropologist colleague, Emma Bakke, you might know from The Geek Anthropologist. And so we got to have a good conversation, sort of getting a bit about Sumana's life story in that. So again, he began leather working at the age of 11 because we kind of said, so how'd you get started? And he was discussing that an older teenager in his village would come back from work every day, and he always had snacks. And Sumana, I remember being a kid saying, well, how do you have snacks? How do you always have money to have snacks? And he says, well, I have a job. He says, what do you do? I work with leather. He says, can I do it too? And he says, come on over. So Sumana apprenticed under him in the shop for 7 years and learned the trade, learned the skill. And then a really interesting turning point was that then he started touring around Niger and parts of West Africa. And then he befriended African designer Alfadi, who then commissioned him to make some leather handbags that he got to then take and show in Europe. And that sort of began Sumana's international experience of traveling in Germany and in the United States, where he actually resides now in Pennsylvania.
If you craftsmen, you want always to support people for craft. I buy sometime for the store, but not really. I want to make sure the product I buy, I know who made it.
It's my first time to be here, so what I'm looking for is just to have opportunity so I can show people how talented people are from Africa in general. Because the way they see Africa in the TV, you know, what they're showing, it's not like that.
Because a lot of people, they see you work in the street and they see the way you dress, the way. It depends because you don't know what in somebody's heart. You don't know where they're looking at you. But the way they look at the designer, for them, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they think they're supposed to see you like a big guy or something like that. I don't know. But most designer, if you see them, you cannot recognize them. You can. You know, and also the designer, most of them is the name. People buy the name, now really the designer. The designer, most of them, they don't design nothing. People design for them. They just have the name to sign it. You cannot see people, they think they good. You have to see the work they do first. You know, because if you don't know the people, by telling them people who I am, some people they're not going to believe me. You know, because I meet a lot of people. I tell them I'm designer. They say, you know, they make faces, and some they say, oh, how? You know, they ask you some question. You know, so you have to show them the proof that you did it. sometimes you don't tell people right away what you're doing. Because I've been here maybe 3-4 years before people they know I can make something. I never told people. I keep that secret because I have to know you before I tell you who I am. You know, I've been outside my country like 18 years, 2000 to 2018 this year. So I have a lot of experience. I see how back home how people work, and I see how here they work in America. Also, I see in Europe how do people from Europeans people work. So I have all these three experience. So I go back home. I say I'm going to set up a school for art. And also, my second dream is whatever I get good enough, I want also to not keep by myself. I want to show the hand of the new generation coming up. They're in Niger now. They're in Niger, yes. You know, because that's the way I grow. And somebody helped me to be who I am now. I want also to do the same thing for the new generation. I don't want to keep that for myself. The people, the person helped me, I don't know him. I never met him. So he's not in my family. I tell people also the same thing, the young people I've been training. I tell them, I want you guys, if you guys good enough to pass the next generation. You don't know, I don't want you guys to say, I have to know you before I hand up you what I know. In my mind, I say I'm going to take like Tory kid, 3-0. And then when I open the school, I have the amount of people, and then every day I go to school, I can see the old people bring them kid. They say, please, can you take my kid because he don't do nothing. I don't want him to sit around all the time. I end up to take Tory. I end up now I have 49 kids in my school. You know, it's not easy. If it's easy, everybody can be artist. But it's not. He take you to festival to have passion. If you don't have passion, you're never going to be a good artist. Because you can start this thing. You can start now. You think, okay, I'm going to start 8 o'clock. Maybe by noon, I may be finished. And something may happen. You have to rip all again. You have to start all again. If you don't have patience, you're going to throw away, so I'm done. It takes time if you really have time, and also you have to be passionate for it. You really have to like it, and you have to believe yourself. You can be a very good artist.
A lot of my experience is in Senegal, and with fashion, or the way that things are made there, you know, you buy your fabric in the marketplace and you have a relationship with the market people, you know, and you haggle, or you negotiate a price and you pick out from what they're doing, or you sometimes can commission a piece or so on. And then you take that to the tailor or the dressmaker, who then you can bring your own design, or they'll have a book with designs. And so it's a real relationship. And often people have the same tailor, the same dressmaker for many, many years. And you know, they know what they do, and they know their quality, and they can bring it back if, you know, they need adjustments and things like that. And, you know, in the States, where many of the things that we buy, especially with the fast fashion, is in a department store, and you don't know the maker, you don't know where the maker came from. Well, you see the little tag, but, you know, you don't know much about it. So I think this is it's training people to look at what they buy in a different way, and in a more responsible way, too. And I think that so much more, I think in the coming years, will have to do with building relationships in all the things that we do, and the things we buy, and the way we interact with people. I think that that in fashion, this kind of thing is what's happening as well.
And so again, we just heard from Diana, and to kind of close out our conversation. And so again, she's the curator of the marketplace at the Folklife Festival. And so I think that the way that she ends that is such a great sort of point to think on and encapsulate our conversation for this episode, is that this is about, like, the marketplace is this place that you can come to not only, like, purchase interesting crafts and fun stuff, but then see the actual craftspeople making them. And there was Kente weavers there. There was Sumana showing his leatherwork. That's where we met Tam and Cynthia, also sharing some of their wares also. But again, they can share the stories of the producers and the designers in Ghana, in Niger, in different parts of Africa and in the continent, as well as in the diaspora. And so, again, it's not, you know, only a place to buy something, but it's a place to be educated and a place to actually build a relationship to know the designers.
It's also interesting to see how the marketplaces, it is a marketplace of where karma happens, and it links back to the larger Folklife Festival theme of heritage enterprise. And being able to see people create artwork and fashion and purchase it, it's sustaining these communities, but it's also connecting them to the continent of Africa and those within the diaspora. And it allows for social development, income generation, a transfer of skills, and piques people's interest in different art forms, as well as art education.
Yeah, I think I want to hit on that last point just for a second too. I think you're absolutely right, and that's why it's so interesting. We heard from Cynthia is doing workshops, Sumana is opening a school for his NGO called Dima. What these folks are doing is they're trying to pay it forward, as it were, you know. And I think that's why it's so interesting. It is skill transfer and it is economic transfer in a way that these people can both, you know, give back to communities, but also help bring these crafts outwards, bring these textiles and these patterns and these fashions outward to the world. And so I think it's quite interesting to see this back and forth. And yeah, I mean, that's, I guess, the marketplace and encapsulation, I suppose.
Well, we hope you enjoyed listening to us. We hope you enjoyed listening to our guests even more. And you can find more about them out online. Check out Cynthia's work at entuma.com. Also check out Tom's online store at lazatom.com. And find Sumana Saleh online on Facebook to find out more on his store, and to check out his school at ngodima.org.
Any comments for us, as always, you can find us at This Anthro Life on Twitter, as well as thisanthrolife@gmail.com. We are always there to answer your questions and emails and stuff, and so we're always happy to hear from the community. And this is a community, you know, these are conversations, so we're bringing you this new idea for episodes, this new sort of format for thinking with multiple guests and you know, running out onto the road and bringing stories back. And so we love doing this kind of work, and so we would love to do more of it. And so we want to know, you know, what you think, what works, what didn't work. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
I'm Ryan Collins.
And I'm Leslie Walker.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode of Culture Made, Heritage Enterprise in a World on the Move, an audio collaboration between This Anthro Life podcast, the American Anthropological Association, and the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage. Today's episode was written by Adam Gamwell, Leslie Walker, and Ryan Collins. This episode, Weaving the Social Fabric, was produced and engineered by Adam Gamwell out of Missing Link Studios, a new media collaborative and collective dedicated to creating narrative media for social impact. Learn more at missinglink.studio. Music provided by Blue Dot Sessions and Dig CC Mixter. Thanks for listening.